This is Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. 8 World Cup matches are coming to East Rutherford, New Jersey in June and July. And soccer is on the minds of so many right now, whether you call it soccer or whether you call it football. My guest can give us a unique perspective on the World Cup, youth soccer, and so much more. Jeffrey Saunders was a 2-time first-team All-American soccer player before playing overseas. And after working in strategic development, innovation, and entertainment with companies like MLB, Nike, and ESPN, he founded a sports consulting and sports data analytics company. He was the president of Estoril Praia of the Portuguese First Division and then president of Everton Sport of the Swiss Super League. Now he serves as the sporting director at Metropolitan Oval. Sports management executive and investor Jeffrey Saunders joins us. Welcome to Sports Jam.
Thanks, Doug. It's an honor to be with you on Sports Jam.
You sent me this morning an amazing article from 1984 that your mother found. It was about you and Matthew Smith. You were both 14 years old, I believe, at the time. And your coach left the team, the Richmond Raiders, while you were spending some time in the Richmond area. You're originally from New York, but your dad was a professor at VCU, and so you were at Richmond at the time. And you didn't have a coach, but that didn't matter. You and Matthew took over the team right then and there.
Yeah, my mom reminds me quite often of this period of my life. I was an avid youth soccer player growing up since I was very young, and counter to what was happening at that time in the United States. I found a love for the game and was obsessed, by every aspect of it, particularly the kind of, the cognitive and strategic elements of the game. And we had this youth team that existed in a youth league down there. And our coach at that time was transferred to another city. And, the team was in jeopardy of potentially not continuing in mid-season. My friend Matthew and I, took over the team as kind of player coaches at that point. I think we were 13 or 14.
Almost like a foreshadowing of what would become your life's passion, this sport of soccer, right?
Well, I've always been affected by the sport. It's probably given me everything that I have in my life and taught me probably all the major lessons that I've needed to learn, from executive function to teamwork to grit and work ethic, cultural diversity and compromise. So, I find that experience starting very young, taught me a lot about the world in which we live and how we need to adapt to operate in such a world.
And before we get into talking about World Cup matches and things like that, I want to go back. First of all, you were a political science major when you were at Hobart and Smith Colleges, and you just didn't play this game. You played it at a high level, and 4 letters in varsity soccer. You set Hobart career records for goals with 44, assists with 26, and points with 114, and you share the single-season mark for assists with 12 and points with 42, a 2-time All-American. That had to be a special time for you because, obviously, you were dominating the pitch.
Listen, I'm very grateful to the environment I was in, the kind of staff and the coaching that was available at that time. I had a European German coach, Willy Steinrotter, who was really amazing person, but also amazing developer of talent, and so fell into a really good environment after spending a lot of all of my youth in kind of youth development organizations around the East Coast. So I'm just thankful that I was able to play at that level, and it was pre-MLS, of course, at that time, and so there wasn't really an opportunity to play in the U.S. to a great extent. So I tried to apply my passion overseas until an injury sidelined that.
Tell us a little bit more about that time when you went overseas to play.
Well, I just think it was, an introduction to the world game, but by being in the world, the U.S. was nascent, of course, to a certain extent in the developmental landscape of football, where we were in our beginnings of this, obviously, in terms of the level of our youth development, and being put in environments where the game has existed for centuries. Was really humbling, and you could kind of compare yourself, not just technically on the pitch, but your level of passion, your level of understanding, the cultural relevance that I'll call it football for this conversation, that football internationally meant. A family, and a player wasn't just connected at a very basic level; they were connected at a core level between generations of their family and their community. And I think that was something that I learned and was very very pleased to be around such passion and such generational connection to the game.
Your journey is really a resume for everything that you've done. Youth development, management, executive. Everything happened, I think, for a reason with Jeffrey Saunders that came through for you. And then you have the opportunity to be a part of these clubs in other countries. First of all, dealing with the language, and how was that for you?
Well, like most, I'm not a quick study at linguistically, but I did worked the best I could to speak a serviceable level of other languages, and so being put in an environment, you do your best, of course, but I think the one thing that that is is important in this is that the language of soccer, the language of football, is really important. I was able to communicate, and I think everyone is able to communicate through these kind of instinctive languages that we all have. Sport and music and film and art. These are languages, that connect us, and we don't necessarily have to speak, the rhetoric or the linguistic style of a specific region. Soccer is this connectivity point. And so I think if you speak, if you speak soccer, or if you speak music, or if you speak these things, you are able to connect in an international environment or in a multicultural environment. Which so I did my best to of course to try to speak in the local tongue, but often the default was the language of soccer.
You talked about how you were really involved pre-MLS. Did you have any idea that soccer, even though it's been a slow growth, would become this popular now in the US?
I think the signs were always there. The soccer existed at the community and cultural level in the US, for a century, till the turn of the 20th century. You had a lot of, immigrant communities that were, proliferating the game around and spreading the game throughout, the urban, particularly the urban communities around the country. So it's always been here, and I think that's what, we talk about quite a bit. I think what's important to realize, the game has always been here. The question is just how has it been, how has it been articulated, and what are the structures that are formed around it? So I would say from a professionalized level, it wasn't until much later in our kind of journey as a country, when soccer was starting to grow, in that sense, in terms of leagues and youth development structures and and media attention and things like that. But I want to be clear that I think, this game and the passion for it has existed here for, over a century.
Yeah, and speaking of over a century, Metropolitan Oval, the oldest continuous youth soccer facility in sports history, sitting in Massapequa, Long Island, and it's been around for that, 100 years plus, 5-acre haven. And you're the sporting director for Met Oval. Tell us a little bit more about why you got involved several years ago, and why this is important for you to continue to build youth soccer and get these athletes prepared. I know legends like Shep Messing and Tony Meola, who we've had on Sports Jam, and Tim Howard was also a guest on Sports Jam. They played on that field. When you started there, this had to be, continuing the passion that you had for youth development.
Yeah, I feel very lucky that I kind of, discovered the Met Oval, which sits, on a, as you said, on a 5 acre, patch in Maspeth, Queens. And I kind of entered the first time through the gates because, my son was a young player, starting off in his developmental cycle, and so I followed him. In theory, and his team into the Met Oval, 15 or 20 years ago, and I was just astounded to, to find this kind of place that reeked of history, but at the same time, it's one of those rare places where the history of the game and the future of the game are happening at the exact same time. Like, so it has this intensity and passion and physical geography that is quite unique, it being the only, the only club-owned field in the boroughs, and as you said, a very historical place. So for me, I just kind of it resonated with me. It was a European feel with a passion and history that I think drives, soccer and soccer development in this country, and gives kind of a, access to all kids of any different cultural background or socioeconomic background. It's a place where everybody has accessibility to the game in all fashions. And so I think it was kind of written once the first day I walked in there. It was very difficult to leave that place. And so I eventually was asked to become a part of the board, and then to try to figure out how to build, to continue the meaningful, mandate of the Oval, which is a not-for-profit organization that has built kind of one of the leading, developmental environments, in the country. So I was very motivated and very passionate about the Oval and its mandate.
The Met Oval Academy has had great success. What have you seen as the difference between the players of today than when you first started?
Yeah, I think, the game is evolving, and those who are accessing the game, the people who are accessing the game are evolving too. So we're seeing, much wider range, let's say, a diversity of players, not just ethnically, but, even economically, and kids who are playing soccer earlier are accessing, these types of environments. And I see that more, now than, let's say, 15, 20 years ago, where it was still a little bit, narrow, in the sense that, you had the kids from the community, particularly immigrant based, who understood the game and the passion for the game, and were seeking out these kind of havens of development and community. Now I see it's a much wider, much wider footprint of the profiles of people who are coming in. And I think, Doug, I think that really represents like what we're missing in some of the other parts of our life as we kind of evolve and become very, the attention economy has created, a lot of, I would say, a lot of, disadvantages for our youth. And I think, the continuity and consistency and community of a place like Met Oval, and of Met Oval specifically, is now something that's attracting people and kids. It's a place. It exists. It has this history and this promise and this passion that reverberates, every day through the field, walking in and hearing, so many different languages, and seeing so many different profiles of kids, and, with so many different backgrounds, gives you some kind of, visibility of a positive future. It's a connectivity point that maybe in the other parts of our life we're maybe missing a little bit.
Every parent thinks they have the next soccer star, and we've heard the term soccer moms, and people go there. I see you laugh when I say that. Can you spot somebody who is 10, 12 and say, stud coming up? Or is it much more than that, Jeffrey? Because I think parents need to have a realistic vision of what level their son or daughter could play at.
No, I think you're right there. I mean, of course, our job as parents is obviously to believe in our kids. And I have many kids, and I have one who a high level soccer player. So I've been on every side of this as a parent, as a professional, as a board member. So I think our jobs is, of course, to support our parent our kids. Dreams and visions, but I think we have to be realistic and not necessarily live through our children. But we have to allow our children to live. And so the support is really important. When you start to kind of, superimpose your wishes or your expectations on your kids to, I think to, outsized degree, we can run into problems. In terms of talent identification, yeah, you'll see kids who are at a very younger age who display acumen or aptitude, but that is not always an indicator of where they're going to end up. And conversely, you may see kids who are late developers who don't show that aptitude at 10, 11, 12, but by, 16, 17 are the top, the top talent, in their group or the top recruited talent. So I try to explain and try to, to speak with parents and say, listen, it's really about the environment, and it's not about any singular moment in a cycle of development. You have to have an environment that can support a player regardless of where they are at any one specific time, and can help them, get to their kind of the ceiling of their, talent and, over a cycle. And so, this is repeated often, and it's very true. Talent alone does not create success. It's talent plus character plus environment. I've seen many kids who have the will to succeed much more than the talent to succeed. So talent alone, being the best talented player at 10, really has, very little bearing on whether you are accessing, a national team, or you get a scholarship to college, collegiately, or you're playing at a high level in the later parts of, let's say, of your high school age years. So, it's not as straightforward. And I think you have to play the long game, and you have to ask very important questions as a parent, and not really focus on this, what I consider unfortunately, the more the American approach, which is the kind of the scoreboard parenting, which is like, okay, if this team is a good team at 10, or the results driven mentality is a really dangerous one. And we tend at Met Oval, and I think if you look internationally, the focus is on development first for the top academies or the top producers, procurers of talent. It's about development and not results. But this leads in, of course, to a much bigger question, which is, in the development versus results kind of paradigm, does the monetization of sports and youth sports in this country distort that, and what's best for development?
Tell us a little bit about your son that's playing at the high level. Where is he at right now? And take us into maybe a conversation you have with him.
So, I was the typical Tiger dad when he was very young, and had to very quickly learn that my experience and my passions as a player and my career could not, overly affect him. It was weighing on him too much when he was young. And so I tried to disconnect to a certain extent myself from his own development. So just playing the supportive role, as I said, once he got to this age. He played at Met Oval. He was a very talented player, but was a late developer in terms of like physically and so forth. So, this is what you see a player like that became overly technical, right? Instead of physical. So he had a cognitive, he developed over time just because of this, a really cognitive and technical acumen in the game, which served him much better when he, became, when he caught up from a development standpoint and was the same or, the same physical size as anyone else. So he went through Met Oval, then was in the first class of kids that went into NYCFC's academy. So when they first launched their academy, they took, a large proportion of their kids from Metropolitan Oval. Balthazar, who's my son, was one of the first in that first wave of kids that was signed to NYCFC, along with Giorena and others in that. They played on the same team, Gio, Joe Scally. A lot of great players, a lot of professional players. I couldn't name them all. But that was his pathway. He ended up at the New York Red Bulls in their academy later. It was really important for us. He was in the national team pools and training camps a little bit, youth national teams. And then it was important for him, I think, and for us as parents that he really use his athletic soccer capabilities to get a higher education. So we were very interested in him, going to school and getting a degree. So he was able to play at a high level in college, went to Villanova and then UConn, just graduated from UConn right now, and played and had a great collegiate career and is now got his undergrad and his master's and all through soccer and now is positioning himself to move into a professional soccer environment. So he'll be joining a professional team in the summer. So.
Fantastic. And following in dad's footsteps for sure. The World Cup coming to New Jersey and other cities here in the US. So is that a big deal for you?
Yeah, I think it's always an amazing opportunity for the media and social focus to be on soccer. When in a landscape here in the U.S. where there's a lot of competing sports and a lot of competing interests, it's a time where we can really single out and talk about soccer and the importance of it, what it represents, as we spoke about before. So I think it is really important. But I always make the distinction that it's a world game, it's a global game, but it's been living here in the US for a century. It is here every day, in places like Met Oval where the World Cup exists every day in the sense that the representation, let's say, in the World Cup of all the teams and the countries that are in the World Cup, they've probably all those kids from all those countries have played at Met Oval over the years, and transited through this development environment. And so I think it's just understanding that that is there and it's always been here in the US. And now it's just a light has been, is being shined on the US's role and, capability when it comes to development and to the passion for the game. And I would say the passion for the game is always here. You just have to have the community and the facilities to, to develop that and to highlight that.
Do you plan on going to any of the matches?
Yeah, I would love to go to some of the matches. I think it's becoming increasingly difficult. Ticket pricing, a lot of the conversations around, transport, and you kind of have this feel which is permeating, as you've seen many of the articles that are being, circulated now and written, about, wait a minute, I thought this was the global game and it's for global access. And then you feel like it's a little bit too monetized. And that can dull a little bit the effect of the World Cup. And I think we have to be careful as a country not to create too much of a corporate environment around something that we're so passionate for, because that can only restrict and prevent new individuals, new families, new players from accessing this passion and this excitement around the World Cup. Much different to go to a game than to watch it on TV. And we're building the new, the new fanatics of soccer in this country. And if we're not accessible, if we don't create accessibility for that, and it's a lesson I've learned at Met Oval in terms of you have to have accessibility, and you have to be this kind of melting pot and bring all these individuals and families together through community and passion. And then you can develop, the next level of development and players and fanaticism. But not if there's an artificial restriction or barrier to access.
Yeah, you talk about accessibility. FIFA has said no parking, right, at MetLife Stadium, changing the name for those couple of weeks. It's not allowed to be MetLife Stadium. It just seems that FIFA has this unbelievable power that the NFL doesn't even have when it comes to sports. What are your thoughts about FIFA?
Listen, I'm not an expert on the internal dynamics. I mean, obviously, I deal with FIFA in my day jobs and dealing with UEFA and FIFA from a club perspective and managing the club perspective. It's tricky. Like, you don't want necessarily an organization that restricts access to a certain amount or is too corporately driven. On the other hand, you do need a strong environment to support the game around the world. So it's a balancing act. And as FIFA does a lot of obviously positive has a lot of positive programs that are supporting the game at many different levels. But on the other side, sometimes you feel like there's too much politics or there's too much corporatization of what should be a democratized event. So I think the jury's out. We'll see what happens with this World Cup, and it's an opportunity that I hope provides a real shot in the arm to soccer and development, and helps the American contribution to the world's game.
What do you think the chances are for the US team?
I hope we can do well. I hope we can exceed I think what is some of our past performances. Our best performance has been a quarterfinal. I think we should definitely get out of our group, and we should probably at least win, get out of the first round of playoffs, and then from there you're probably meeting some of the top clubs, top teams from top countries in the world. So it's hard to predict any one game. This is any given moment type of thing. We can perform. We have the players who can perform. We actually have a world-class coach. Is the structure, again, institutionalized, that will allow us to do this time and time again? I don't think so. Can we do it? Of course we can. And I'm hoping for the good of the game, that we will have a very positive performance. How far that goes, I can't say, but I just want there to be, success in terms of the games. And there's a lot of turbulence, let's say, now, of course, with Matt Crocker leaving the Federation, and a lot of the changes that are ongoing, and a lot of the, I would say, the, let's say, political tug of wars that's happening throughout the kind of soccer environment in the US. I don't think it will have any major effect on the outcome of the World Cup, but it will have an effect on our long-term, the long-term viability of creating a world-class, soccer infrastructure and team that competes at a world level, which I don't think we're there yet. But I think we have the possibility to get there.
There certainly will be a lot of young kids that will be inspired to play this sport after they hear all the hubbub about the World Cup matches. That certainly has happened on the women's side for a long time. And then, behind me, you see Lavelle's jersey there. We have Gotham FC being a tremendous team in the area on the women's side. I guess it's the beauty of this sport that both men and women can play it at a high level. And it's such an easy sport. Roll the ball out. To be great, different. But to play the game is wonderful.
Agree. I think accessibility is key, and you've been referencing it, and so have I. If you can create accessibility for all, individuals, regardless of gender, regardless of socioeconomic background, regardless of cultural background, regardless of physical, let's say, size, like we can create an environment that's accessible for all. And I think that's what creates this passion, and is the accessibility and the simplicity of what it takes to play. A ball in any space is basically what you need. And if you look at these, international environments, or countries that have developed, generations and generations of top talent, it's because you still see them playing in the streets and having unstructured, play spaces, or they make their own environments to play. And if you have enough passion and enough will to play, you just go and play. Very simple, without the kind of structures that I think we've maybe created too much of a structured environment, in some capacities, in the US, because that's what we do, and it serves us very well in a lot of areas. I think we need to move back to access, an unstructured play at an early level, where kids can touch the passion, and then we keep them later. But if they're not passionate because there's too much focus on early results, or early, too early, like a very rigid structure, we may, not keep them in the system long enough. I'll give you an example. At Met Oval, of course, we try to have all levels of talent being represented. We want a pathway to a professional environment, which we've done, many, many times for kids. We want to have a pathway to collegiate environments for, hundreds of kids that go on and play in college. But we also want to have an environment where you can come and play when you're young. And if it's a meritocracy to a certain extent, like if you want to come and you want to play, you can play, and there's a level for you. If Even if you're a female at Met Oval, who traditionally we used to have female women's programs, but instead we just kind of said, well, if you want to play, we have a kind of co-ed environments where if you're good enough, you play. And we have had a lot of examples of women who play with the boys' teams and go on to a significant extent. So, in summary, I think it's accessibility and the environment which is really going to drive, drive soccer fandom, both on and off the pitch. And places like Met Oval, when you go, you feel something. Like, it's very clear. The same way as I would walk into a parking lot in Egypt and find a game happening, or in South America, or in Belgium, or in Switzerland, or in Portugal. Like, you can just walk outside and find soccer. Like, and then you can integrate with it, and it's inclusive. It doesn't matter that I don't speak the language. It doesn't. This is the experience of my life, that everything that has created created meaningful interaction for me has kind of been through the language of soccer.
Well, thanks to this New York-born soccer enthusiast and executive, that 14-year-old who took over the Richmond Raiders is responsible for so many families loving the game of soccer and creating some spectacular players through the years. Jeffrey Saunders, it's been a pleasure to have you on Sports Jam. Enjoy the World Cup and continued success.
All right, Doug, thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Sports Jam is a WBGO News production. You can check out all the past shows by going to wbgo.org/sportsjam, or find Sports Jam with Doug Doyle on the NPR list of podcasts or wherever you hear podcasts. Special thanks going out this week to Joe Favorito for hooking us up with Jeffrey Saunders. Until our next Sports Jam session, I'll see you at the game.